This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We had a special out and about edition live from the St. Regis downtown Dubai, speaking to Ruth Archer and Chef Paolo about the hotel, their sustainable afternoon tea, and kept it environmental. We had a climate panel, Arbor School, Azraq, and 17-year-old Pratisha, who's founded her own organisation, as we talked about the very real eco-anxiety that so many people are suffering from. And it was, of course, Pets and Vets with Dr. Mina. He was taking your questions, and we uncovered some other rules and regulations around flying with pets in light of that headline this week. Plus, hiking with your hound. Hussein Darwish rounding up some of the best spots to go to and how you can get involved this weekend.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
It is Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer. We are live from the St. Regis downtown Dubai. Dr. Mina Rabadi, City Vet Clinic, standing by. Dr. Mina, let's talk about that biggest pet story of the week. Passengers flying with Etihad Airways can now travel with their pets in their cabin, as long as, of course, you pay an additional fee and meet certain criteria. So it's going to cost economy travellers about 550 dirhams per pet for a flight of 6 hours or less, and 920 dirhams for flights of more than 6 hours. So it's going to allow trained service animals and pet cats and dogs on board. What are your thoughts when it comes to travelling with pets? Any tips? I can't even imagine travelling with my spaniel.
Yeah, so first of all, that's an amazing news for pets owners, and definitely it's a big relief for them. Mm-hmm. About taking a pet, of course, on the plane, you need to go through the whole process of confirmation for the bookings, whatever. Then by us veterinarians, we need to make sure that the dog is medically okay to go on.
Well, that's an interesting point, because we've had a number of questions in the past about older dogs travelling.
Yeah.
And I remember being really surprised by what our vet of the day said, which was, you might think that some older dogs shouldn't fly, but actually they could be quite placid and relaxed and would be okay. Has that been your experience as well?
Definitely. Wow. If the animal is healthy, he can go whenever you want, wherever you want. The things that we are afraid of, we have a concern toward them, pets with severe anxieties, mm-hmm. pets with congestive heart failure, heart problems, which their medical situation is not that stable. They are on medication. These are the only concerns, actually. But now also having this great news that the pet will stay with the client on board, that's actually more safer now. As it goes, that's amazing.
I think the anxiety is often on the human as well, thinking, I can't see my pet for, you know, definitely. 10 hours or so. They might want a different flight. Worrying about, you know, simply not knowing where they are and what's happening to them.
Definitely, yeah.
There must be some breeds where you think, you can't have a Great Dane next to you on a flight. Yeah. there must be some weight and size limitation, surely.
Yeah, of course. There are some certain breeds. They are not allowed to go into the flights.
Do we know where they are or not?
The Mastiff. Any breeds that they show aggression, mm-hmm. they can also follow the website, and everything is mentioned there by the point. Also, size do matter, because there are some limitation for the size.
Do they sit on the seat?
So you have two options, okay. whether they're going to go under your seat, especially for small cats mm-hmm. and small breeds. The other option that you can buy another seat beside you, they can enjoy the ride with you all the time.
Got visions. I mean, surely Etihad's going to introduce some kind of pet TV channel, you know, a little doggy eye mask.
Yeah.
What about meals? This raises so many questions.
Yeah, definitely. The meals. First of all, it should be only dry food.
Yes. And think about the smell.
It should be also in a closed container, not to bother fellow people.
They all have to be in some kind of crate.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Just dry food, nothing else.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
It is Pets and Vet, and joining us live from City Vet Clinic here at St. Regis is Dr. Mina. You're getting some love on the SMS message here saying Dr. Mina is the best from Thor and Sugar. Are Thor and Sugar people or animals?
They are animals. But for me, they are a family. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Oh, well, we've had lots of questions for you as well. And I just want to quickly go back to our discussion around flying with pets. As we heard, yeah. Etihad Airways has now announced you can fly with your animal. Of course, certain guidelines are in place. But what about animal comfort? What if you do have an animal that perhaps wouldn't be so anxious that they couldn't fly, but yeah. could be nervous, and you don't want to be a bother to other passengers? Is there anything you can do as a pet owner?
Yeah, so usually we take the full history from the client and also try to understand the anxiety level that their pets have. We have some meds to calm them down, which can the effect is at within 30 to 60 minutes, and we have some medication that you need to start them earlier before the flight, a couple of days. So depend on the anxiety level, depend on the dog itself. Of course, it's always better to see the dog multiple times to be able to judge, because some people are just, they love their animal that much and they can go a bit extreme with their anxiety, and you might over-medicate. We don't want that.
No.
So, yeah.
What about temperature in the cabin?
Temperature in the cabin, usually they recommend you to provide a towel or something that
a woolly jumper. Yes.
That would be definitely something absorbent underneath them in case they
need to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
Which they probably will during the course of a flight. So just be prepared.
Yeah.
We're going to go to the text line. Many questions coming in for you, Dr. Mina. As I said, you get advice. A message here, and extra points, by the way, for including the name of your animal. What age should I get my English bulldog, Dave, neutered? Dave the Bulldog, this is exceptional. Recommended ages for neutering, does it tend to differ between breeds? What would you say for an English Bulldog?
There are some new studies suggesting, of course, taking the breed into consideration. But usually when we advise them to do the surgery at least after hitting maturity. Some schools would say earlier, some school would say just wait more. It's still a grey area of studies, but definitely we'll say after the first period or after the male get
active,
yeah. But we need to do it in that, it's a gray area, because you need to do it before he start developing any behavioral issues, aggression toward other dogs especially. And now daycares are more open to the fact that you need to sterilize your animal before getting him into the daycare, not to have any incidents. So yeah, we are doing it now between the age, I'm not going to give you an exact age, but let's say between 8 months up to 1 year, that's
and
the recommended one.
Question, Dr. Mina, if anyone's listening and perhaps they have an animal that they haven't neutered but they want to, is it ever too late? If you've got, say, a six-year-old dog, can you still have that dog neutered?
No, definitely. In some cases, actually, doing the surgery will eliminate some problems that we might see on older age, especially with males, any prosthetic problems, including tumors, and they are known to be aggressive and bad. The thing that might not change actually is the behavior, because for them now it's a habit more than a hormonal driven problem. But yeah, definitely neutering is always advisable,
always beneficial, guys. Hope that helps. And a question here saying, my 8-year-old lab Sparky has tear stains that just don't go away. Can we help Susie and Sparky?
Yeah, of course, but we need to know the color of your dog.
Let's
first
say Sparky, I think,
because usually
I'm going to go golden. Sounds golden.
Usually white dogs, let's say, or the dogs which are more on the bright color, you will see more stains on them. Sometimes it's no medical condition to be concerned about, but sometimes it's related to some eye issues. Some studies will tell you about probiotics to go with them, but to be honest, I need to see the dog first to see whether this is just a normal stain, which can be eliminated or reduced by some products, or it's an eye problem that need to be treated.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
Wonderful to have you with us this Wednesday afternoon, and wonderful joined by Dr. Mina from City Vet Clinic here live at the St. Regis downtown Dubai to answer any of your pet-related questions, concerns, something that might be on your mind, maybe symptoms that just aren't adding up. Massive thank you to everyone who's been in touch with pictures. We've had hamsters, we've had Sugar and Thor getting in touch with some very, very handsome photos. These are your patients,
yeah.
Doctor.
Yeah.
That is one small dog with a big personality,
big
I can just tell.
Definitely, yeah.
And Thor has a nose that I just want to bop. Susan's wanting to know, signs of a healthy cat. Is it true that if a cat has a wet nose, it's a sign of good health? I've heard this in dogs, but never cats. Is that
true?
Yeah,
so it depends on the amount, how wet the nose is, because sometimes it's a sign of upper respiratory problem.
So you want moist but not snotty?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
And as long as your cat is running and playing, that's always a good sign.
Okay, hope that helps, Susan. And Gendra's saying, I want to ask the doctor about the best recommended food for any dog. What do you say, kibbles or raw? And are there any fruits and vegetables you should avoid giving a dog? Thank you. Let's start with the kibbles versus raw. And it's a bit of a contentious one. There's lots of people who are very dedicated to that raw diet and put a lot of time and research into kind of putting together an ideal program, but perhaps not as much time as companies do when it comes to massive research and development teams. What do you think from your years of training?
For me, definitely, I would go with the kibbles. They put a lot of studies, a lot of invention in these stuff, more than just a usual raw diet. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of precautions you need to take care of when you do a raw diet, especially if you have kids at home. It's somehow dangerous. So for me, I would recommend just going with the kibbles. It's easier. And even when you do a raw food, you need to make sure that you are supplying with all the nutrients your
dog's
need.
That's what I was
just
about to say to you. We were just saying off air that my dog is on a special renal diet because he's got some kidney problems. And that would be impossible to incorporate into a raw diet because you simply can't control.
Definitely. They can achieve part of it, but definitely not the full 100% provided by the kibbles. Yeah.
And in terms of fruit and vegetables to avoid giving dogs, ours love cucumber. They're mad for cucumber.
Yeah.
And carrots, and that's kind of all we give them. Is there anything they could benefit from, and what for should everyone be avoiding?
For me, whether it was safe or don't go overboard with it. Just you can use it as a treat, but let's say grapes, avoid them.
Definitely.
Raw onion, even cooked onion, I wouldn't trust it, but usually we talk about raw onion. Garlic, one of the it causes blood hemolysis and oxidant changes, so also stay away from this one. Chocolate, I think everyone knows, and mainly these are always check before you go for anything.
Okay, and watch out for those breeds that tend to steal from the table.
We'll try as much as we can to control it. Keep everything off the floor. Always swipe with your eyes before you let your dog go, whether into the garden or the salon, especially when you have kids. We deal with a lot of problems, especially cakes and dark chocolate, when you have child at home. Yeah.
Okay.
So these things, always keep it in consideration.
Jared saying, on Saturday night, my dog was making a retching type cough through the night about 6 times. The next day, he coughed a few more times, but he seemed his normal bouncy self and eating well. Since then, the coughs almost disappeared. It sounded like a bit of a rattle. Could it be kennel cough or something else? He's never had kennel cough before, so I don't know what it sounds like. I'm not going to make you do a demonstration of kennel cough. Don't worry.
I can, by the way.
You can?
It's easy, yeah.
Go on. Did it sound like that, Jared? So what is kennel cough, and does this sound like a kind of retching type noise that he describes?
So before we diagnose and say that's a kennel cough, we need to know the breed of the dog, because some dogs, they will do cough. That's a breed related issue. We need to know how old is the dog, any other problem, cardiopulmonary problems. Is the dog vaccinated for kennel cough or not? Was he recently in a daycare or not? Some people will get mix a lot between a cough and sneeze or reverse sneeze. So literally,
what is a reverse sneeze?
I need to show you how you
okay,
can do
go
it.
On.
That's why. So a sneeze will be outward. A reverse one will be it's like he's taking it inside.
Okay.
Sometimes it's related to foreign body. Sometimes it's related to stenosis. So usually we ask them to take videos, or we start showing them how it looks like. I do a lot of
demonstrations
in the clinic. Yeah.
So Joe, we need a bit more information, but it does sound like a chip the vet might be useful just to get that checked out.
Yeah, definitely. But if he stopped, usually kennel cough will take more days to... But he needs to get his dog checked, definitely.
Okay. I love this question from Christine saying, good timing, thank you guys. I'm going to be looking after my friend's 7-month-old short hair for 3 days. We've been around him in his own home, but he's never been to our place before. He's lively but endearing. This sounds like a euphemism, Christine. We're going to have his litter tray, bed, feeding stuff, scratch post, planning on shutting all the doors so we don't need to extract a reluctant cat from under the beds. Yeah. No windows open, and being careful about doors. He's an indoor cat. Is there anything about potential behaviour that I need to plan for or be aware of? Christine, you sound like a wonderful friend. What would you say about making a cat perhaps feel at home and relaxed?
So the most important thing, that you need to give him his time. That's the first thing. Between three, some cats will go up to 7 days. Some relaxing music proved to be helpful in this situation. Yeah, definitely. Try to avoid strong smells. Especially here, we use a lot of oud, refresheners.
Mm-hmm.
So these things, try to avoid them, because they will cause some kind of a a stress for them. Loud noises, other pets around the house, kids, because usually most of
I've got two kids who are basically semi-professional cat botherers.
Yeah. They will just choke them with love.
They love them too hard.
That's the thing, yeah. Okay. So mainly these are the things that you need to watch for. Relaxing music, I advise you to go for it, yeah. And it shows
I love the sound. Yeah. I'm sure there's a YouTube channel set up somewhere for
relaxing
cat music.
Yeah, we used to try
music.
Them with our impatient.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And sunlight. So main things, I would say sunlight should be always presented for cat and relaxing music, especially for the new ones.
Okay, and yeah, if you have got kids, Christine, try and explain the power of giving a cat space. But time, I think, is a really wise word. Eddie, thank you for this message. Sound like a wonderful pet parent here, saying, I've got a 12-year-old dog who's got a lot of tartar on her teeth. The vets recommended a clean under a general anaesthetic. Apart from the cost, yeah, tell me about it, I'm concerned about her surviving the procedure. She's got heart issues, is on 3 types of tablet. Would be better to have it done now rather than later when she is older and it becomes a necessity. I just can't seem to make a decision. If she passes away under the anaesthetic, I would never forgive myself. Oh. Eddie, this is the pain of being a pet parent, isn't it? Trying to make decisions hearing that about this dog's general health and age, what would you advise?
So, of course, he will have a general checkup before he go into sedation. Second of all, we need to do a full blood analysis to assess his liver, kidney, all of his RBCs. Means the blood totally to see whether if there is anything out of ordinary, and there are special pre-medication for dogs with heart issues.
Okay.
Safe combination of meds, and my advice, of course, is to go for it now because teeth tartar will cause further problem to the dog, and might also go as crazy as septicemia and hit other organs if it's that bad.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have just a small amount of tartar and your dog is still good enough for it, just go for it.
Okay, really hope that helps, Eddie, and all the best to your pooch as well. Ivy's been in touch with the name of a cat. The cat is called Tiny. Thank you, Ivy. My cat Tiny is hissing and growling at me when I go near her. She's normally really affectionate. 1-year-old, usually loves to cuddle and stroke, but the last 24 hours she's become aggressive when we go to stroke her. She's eating and drinking fine and has no obvious injury or illness. Do we need to go to the vet? So yeah. A sudden behaviour change.
So hissing is usually our middle name in the vet clinic because that's how cats call us. How old is she?
She's only a year.
Okay, was she spayed or not?
Doesn't say.
Okay, so that one thing we need to make sure of. Second of all, some cats, it's a different personality. Some cats are lab cats, the other ones are not. Some of them are alpha cats. They tend to be a bit territorial. So, yeah, a checkup about this thing would be the best thing I can recommend at the moment.
Dr. Mia, thank you so much for your time today.
You are so welcome.
It's been a pleasure to have you here at
thank
the St.
So
Regis
much.
Dubai. And you can find Dr. Mina, as many people have been getting in touch, saying a big thank you for your patience in real life and on the SMS at City Vet thank Clinic there on Alwassel Road.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live from St. Regis, downtown Dubai. Live exquisite.
Fantastic to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon. It's 11 minutes past 3, and I always know it's a good panel, the right people in the room when they've got lots to say to each other, and delighted to be joined now by a group of really passionate individuals who are doing their best to help young people with climate anxiety. But what is it? Climate anxiety is real. It's, we think about definition, it's climate or eco-anxiety. Described by the American Psychological Association as a chronic fear of environmental doom. And there's a fairly recent psychological disorder affecting an increasing number of individuals who worry about the environmental crisis. Are you part of that group? And do you have any solution? Joining us today live from the St. Regis downtown Dubai is Brett Govan. He's the principal of Arbor School. It's a school here in Dubai that gives a real emphasis and importance on environmental education. They've got an in-house bio farm, a bio park, a living classroom as well. Amanda Resch, she's a board director of ASRAC. It's a non-profit group that's really active in marine conservation in particular. And joining us as the voice of the youth, Prakash is with us. She is the co-founder of EcoTet. It's a student-led initiative that has some really big goals, curbing the immediate effects of climate change through some really impressive projects, including a pilot run in a labour camp in Sharjah. So thank you all for being with us this afternoon. Amanda, would you say climate anxiety is real? Lots of headlines around it now because of COP26, but given the conversations you're having with people in general, climate anxiety on the rise and a real problem?
I think it's hugely real. I'm of the age where I think a lot of my friends are all starting to think about kids, if not already on that train. And the the biggest conversation is, should we, if we're not going to be around in 50 years, or if the planet won't be habitable in the next 100, is it right for us to make that next step, not knowing the future that we're leaving behind for them? So I definitely think climate anxiety is real. I have it myself. I mean, you can't live in Dubai on the ocean and not see, I think, the damage that is caused on a global scale with global warming and the plastics that wash up from wherever they came from, which is often thousands and thousands of miles away. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think climate anxiety is definitely something we live with. I think the youth definitely is feeling it more
tuned in, I think, than ever before. But I think there seems to be quite a wide range. There's some people who choose to bury their heads in the sand, and it's like, you know, I'm just not going to think about that because it doesn't actually help me very much. And there's those, you know, such as you guys this afternoon and many people listening today, who choose to be engaged and make active decisions to play a part to change the conversation and hopefully change the future of the planet. And Brett, what would you say there to Amanda's point about the youth being more tuned in? And, you know, at ARBA they start from FS1, so age 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. What kind of conversations are you having in the classroom to inform kids but perhaps not terrify them?
I think kids turn into, you know, inverted commas, eco-warriors overnight. Mm-hmm. You know, they will very quickly start switching off lights and stop using plastic. What we can do in school is we can educate very quickly, but a majority of their intent to act actually happens at home. So really, we won't achieve our mission as a school with sustainability unless we can actually reach beyond our borders to the parents. Mm-hmm. So biggest impact is there. The second bit for us about eco-anxiety is we deliberately have a rule, which is no disasters till age 10. No disasters, because you can teach helplessness. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you put in front of disasters, you know, look at this disastrous image, they learn helplessness. They mm-hmm. say, well, I can't do anything, and so they slowly just retract. So
what's the message instead? How do you communicate and make an impact? And
optimism, things that we can do.
And so control.
Make an effort, control this, do something, take a small step, put something in front of them that we can find a solution to, and then you slowly, progressively build up to, okay, now here's a bigger challenge, what are we going to do about this one? Mm-hmm. So the idea is that if you can progressively build that over time, is they'll get to a point where they realise they can make a difference.
And Brett, you should tell us a little bit about when you started to really get an understanding of our place in the world and where the planet could be going in the future. Was that a conversation at home or one at school?
I've always learned about global warming and climate change at school, and like all my friends are aware of it. We all have ideas, but we're not sure how to make them into a reality. Mm-hmm. And it's always a conversation that we always have. And at school, we always know what we can do. Like, we always recycle paper and plastic, and it's just like the furthest step and making our plans into action.
Which is exactly what you've done. I mentioned that pilot scheme in the Labour camp in Sharjah. What does it actually look like? Can you explain what you're hoping to implement and what's happening in that camp?
What we've done is we take hydroponic systems and then we install them at various labour camps across UAE so that the labourers can actually grow their own food. Most labourers actually save most of their money so they can send them back home, so they don't actually get like the most nutritious food. So I felt like this would be the best way to like combine both the problems and solve them with one way.
Oh, this is what we need. Fresh ideas. And thank you for being with us this afternoon.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live from St Regis, downtown Dubai. Live exquisite.
Hope you're having a wonderful Wednesday so far. And we're talking climate anxiety. A recent survey of 1,000 young people found that anxiety and distress over the climate crisis was affecting their daily life, their ability to function, their mental health. 3/4 of respondents aged 16 to 25 felt that, quote, the future is frightening. The poll was done by academics in the UK. So do you agree or disagree? Numbers aside, there are, you know, you seem to look at the news, look at the weather, people losing their homes, livelihoods, seeing their beloved villages and towns devoured by wildflowers and fires and flash floods. So we're talking about climate anxiety this afternoon, but also empowering you to make some changes. And it's not just a case of recycle, but maybe some things you haven't thought of before. And we've got a brilliant panel together who are talking about it from all sorts of different angles. Amanda Rushworth is with us, the board director at ASHRAC. It's a non-profit group that's really active, especially when it comes to marine conservation. Prayesha Paresh is with us, the co-founder of EcoTare. It's a student-led initiative that is determined to curb the immediate effects of climate change through some really impressive projects, including hydroponics in labour camps in Sharjah to help labourers grow their own food. And Brett Girvan is here, principal of the ARBA School. There they've got an in-house bio farm, they've got a bio park, a living classroom. into teaching children as young as three about what they can do for the future of the planet. You mentioned earlier, Brett, that you've got a kind of a no disasters until 10 philosophy, which is about not scaring children, but really kind of empowering them to make small changes, you know, every single day. We were literally just saying off air about, you know, my kids will come home and say, you know, mummy, you need to recycle that, or we can use that for junk modelling. What are some of the things that you're doing around the school on a very practical basis that the kids and students and parents and teachers can see every single day?
I think the key thing is it's not just a green lens. This is a, for all of us, this is a transformative change of society and worldview that's going to actually change it, because the recycling bit is important, but it's only a tiny wee piece. Picking up the plastics is really important, but it's post hoc, right? The thing's already happened. So we've actually got to cut this thing down at source. So it's trying to get the children to change their behaviours from, you know, from the root cause. So being connected with nature, understanding some of the fundamental concepts of ecology, thinking about networks and systems and knowing that that affects that, which affects that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the kind of theory that goes behind this is your start point. And then for the children, how does that, what does that look like? It just means being in nature. It means connecting with nature. It means playing in the mud as much as doing your phonics. And those things are what people love. Who doesn't love doing mud pies when you're 3 years old? So it's active, it's engaged, it's being out in nature, but it's at the same time realizing that, you know, if we don't have eco-literacy, mm-hmm. you know, then we will never have that fundamental understanding of how to make improvements. So it's really buying into the theory as much as the play.
Can I ask you, when thinking about that statistic, you know, a huge number of young people, 75% saying the future is frightening. How old are you?
I'm 17.
Okay, so you're right in this age bracket of the mm-hmm. 16 to 25. Would you agree with that? How do you feel about the future being frightening?
I really think the future is frightening. My friends and I always joke about, oh, what if we never even get that age because of the environment and the world?
Oh, my goodness. But, oh, my goodness. Yeah. And are you saying this in a kind of...
We know, say it as a joke, but deep down we know.
Really?
It's possible.
What are some of your major concerns when you look at what you're seeing in the news, what you're reading, what you're researching, what you're looking to address? Is climate change the big one for you, and what aspect of it?
In climate change, like, I feel like there's many consequences from climate change, like food insecurity and like just air pollution and pollution in general. But all together, they all join hands and like cause a destructive force for Earth. So I feel like just tackling one area would not be enough. Mm-hmm. But I feel like if we tackle like all of them simultaneously, we might make an effect.
It's interesting because this is potentially a really big opportunity for whole industries, new businesses, new enterprises, entrepreneurs. Do you think this will be part of your career in the future? Is this something you'd like?
I hope, yeah.
Yeah, what would you want to do?
I'm applying for a college as a course of environmental engineering because I think... Like, you know how there's industrial revolution? I think that if we create, like, a product, but we make it a sustainable product, make everyone actually use it, that would be the future. Like, that would be a more sustainable future. Like, that's what I hope.
I don't want you to reveal your idea in case someone steals it, but you can tell us off air. Master Shea is saying, I have eco-anxiety. Stop manufacturing plastic bags. We're going to talk about some of the things we can do day-to-day to reduce the consumption before, as Brett says, we even get to the recycling stage.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live from St Regis, downtown Dubai. Live exquisite.
This is not about some expensive, politically correct green act of bunny hugging or blah, blah, blah. Build back better, blah, blah, blah. Green economy, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, 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 net zero, blah, 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 climate neutral, blah, blah, blah. This is all we hear from our so-called leaders. Words. Words that sound great, but so far has led to no action. Our hopes and dreams drown in their empty words and promises. Of course, we need constructive dialogue, but they've now had 30 years of blah, 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 and where has that led us? But, of course, we can still turn this around. It is entirely possible. It will take drastic annual emission cuts, unlike anything the world has ever seen. And as we don't have the technological solutions that alone can deliver anything close to that, That means we will have to change. We can no longer let the people in power decide what is politically possible or not. We can no longer let the people in power decide what hope is. Hope is not passive. Hope is not blah, blah, blah. Hope is telling the truth. Hope is taking action. And hope always comes from the people.
Greta Thunberg there speaking passionately as ever. And we've got three passionate, I don't want to say eco-warriors, but certainly some people who are incredibly more informed than me when it comes to all things environment. Brett Gerben is with us this afternoon, the principal of Arbor School. Amanda Rushford, the board member at ASRAC, and Pratyusha Kaparish is the co-founder of EcoTare. And we're having something of a roundtable off the back, of course, of COP26, dominating the headlines. We'd love your ideas, your thoughts on eco-anxiety, an alarming number of 16 to 25-year-olds saying how the future is frightening. No name on this one. Animal agriculture is one of the leading causes of climate change. Going plant-based, reducing our intake of animal products could help. We love your ideas. We love your solutions as well. Amanda, I wanted to go to you because I know you've obviously been following COP26 and there's been some very big headlines, but you've been keeping an eye on some of the smaller discussions that have been had. What have been some of your big takeaways so far?
Well, I think with COP26, obviously the biggest takeaway that came out of it that was very public was the reduction in deforestation. But in all intents and purposes, the route to a much more sustainable environment and a future that we can all be happy to live in is immediate. We need to make immediate change because ocean acidification is actually what we should be worried about.
I've never heard that term before in terms of, I mean, I've heard the phrase before, but not in terms of that immediacy and the impact it could have on, what, the next decade, 50 years? What are we looking at?
Well, the terrifying truth, and I don't want to be negative Nancy, and because I'm kind of known for that, unfortunately, is to giving the scary truths, but since the 1950s, we've lost 50% of all marine mammals and marine animals, and this includes obviously some of the biggest, or smallest rather, phytoplankton, which gives us oxygen. So they say 8 out of every 10 breaths is produced by the oceans, so not by the land, which means that all the focus on deforestation and no focus at all on reducing the amount of chemicals that go into the ocean and reducing the amount of plastics that are in the ocean is not going to help us. And in 10 years' time, it does say that we are likely, unfortunately, to hit the pH of 7.95, which means that a further 70 to 80% of all marine life looks set to end, because if the ocean pH goes down, we lose all the calcium elements that are in the ocean, which give us oxygen and sequester carbon.
So, Amanda, when we think about our day-to-day choices, the kind of conscious, you know, behaviourals we make when it comes to shopping, and let's look at shopping in particular, actually. I know you're passionate when it comes to fashion as well and work with a lot of brands here who have sustainability at their very core. But what about things like sunscreen, for example, when talking about the ocean? Because that is a huge source of chemicals that shouldn't be there, damaging that reef life. Mm.
So oxybenzene is the active ingredient in sunscreen. And this is one of the biggest, we call it forever chemicals, that's in the ocean today. So it means it's not going away, it cannot dissolve. And unfortunately, we're making that conscious choice to put sunscreen on, not knowing the pollution we're doing.
And I think that's a really good point. It's not knowing. People aren't putting on sunscreen going, ha, 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 I'm going to go and kill some fish today. It's simply not talked about. And if we are, there are brands out there, of course, that are really striving to communicate that message and, you know, put that on their labelling, tell people. And as it stands right now, they're more expensive because the demand isn't there, because the knowledge isn't there. But, you know, what kind of responsibility do we have as consumers to actually fuel a change? Would big brands listen?
Yes, they'll listen to the data. Mm-hmm. So as consumers, it's our responsibility to be more conscious. Every time we make a purchase, that data is fed back to the manufacturers. So if we purchase sustainable or natural fibres, they'll make more of that product. Now,
because they're chasing the profits.
Because, of course, it's the P&L.
Yeah.
But we can help change that as consumers by looking at labels. Labels are your most important tool for a more sustainable future, whether it's in fashion or any industry, to be honest. Labels are important, and it's being informed on what you need to look for. We're looking for natural fibers. We know that even if it does end up in landfill, it'll biodegrade quite happily. But if we choose materials in any way, shape or form that have plastic in them, then of course they're going to leach chemicals into the environment and the oceans, and microplastics are going to end up in our food chain, which is a terrifying thought when 2 billion people survive on the food that comes from the ocean.
Let us know your thoughts on this afternoon, guys. We'd love to hear from you. I wanted to ask you, Patricia, a little bit about what your hopes are. If you could wave a magic wand for us as individuals, everyone listening today, to change one thing about our behaviour or attitude, what do you think we need to understand or indeed do?
Yeah, I think the main thing is to be conscious about what we're buying and actually understand that the small product that we might just buy is actually fueling an entire industry. And just that small product is causing this entire climate change and causing all these problems. So if we actually understood the gravity of what we're doing, we'd actually understand that we should stop and we should actually alter our choices. So I think that's my choice.
I think choice is a really key word there, because you can choose to be informed, you can choose to educate yourself, you can choose to be like, no, this is someone else's problem and I'm not going to think about it because it's a bit depressing.
Yeah.
Or choosing to listen today and be with us and hopefully learn something or even just think is really, really valuable. Amanda, what would you say about that kind of the choice to engage?
It's exactly the point. We have wonderful people like Greta Thunberg in the world who are bringing light to the problem, but in all essence, it's not the big companies that will make that change for us. A lot more of us in the world who have that small dollar opportunity to make an effect change, and that is all done with our consumer purchases. So being a conscious consumer is the only way we're going to help reduce the problems that are obviously caused and have access to. We're not politicians. We're not going to be able to make that change, you and I, but we can help make that change from a grassroots level. And people think, oh, you know, what can
Who
I
am
do?
I?
What
yeah.
can I do? I'm not, you know, anyone important. I'm not going to be able to, you know, change the world by picking up one piece of plastic on the beach. But it does help, because if everybody has that same thought, then there's a lot more of us in terms of manpower who are going to make that change happen.
It's the same question to you then, Amanda. If you could wave a magic wand, I wish I had that for you. What kind of attitude or behaviour would you like to see everyone listening today to make?
I think there's many things we can wish for. I think the most important thing moving forward is buying plastic products. Always search for a sustainable alternative, and there is one. Mm-hmm. There's always a sustainable alternative, whether it's a water filter at home over plastic bottles, or your own reusable canvas bags versus the plastic bags, and they're on a very grassroots level. Mm-hmm. But it's reducing the production of plastic by stop buying it, basically. So we can make that change. It doesn't have to be a wish anymore.
And what about you, Brett? I know you're making choices, you know, every day at ARBA, from sustainable uniforms to, of course, the choice to educate kids in every lesson, not just about having dedicated, you know, lesson plans around the environment. But for every parent listening today, when it comes to their kids, are there any choices you think we should be making?
Well, you give me the hard one to talk about parents. I think the two other panelists here have said it's about choices. Really seriously about choices, and you can choose to understand and believe that we are connected and it is our responsibility. I think that's probably the number one. It is this has to be a grassroots movement with some sort of federal level intervention, but the first bit is it's our responsibility. No one is coming to save us here, and I think I've said before, this is not a put the brakes on the buses nearing the edge of the cliff. This is we're already both front wheels off the edge of the cliff. We need to back the bus up, and that's a decision we have to make right now.
Thank you all of you for getting involved this afternoon, and wishing everyone the best with their endeavours. I will be tagging you all on social media so can people follow what you've been up to, and as I said, choose to educate themselves more, and I'm definitely include myself in that. I think we've all got room for improvement, and thank you for being with us.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer,
live from St Regis downtown Dubai. Live exquisite.
I am Helen Farmer, and we are not in the studio. We are live at the St. Regis downtown Dubai, newly opened, stunning hotel. I can see sunlight glimmering on the canal, and joined now by the Director of PR and Marketing, Ruth Archer, who, fun fact, we went to the same high school.
We did.
Isn't that so strange?
Small world, Helen.
I'm a few years older. But yeah, if you hear my northeast accent coming out a little bit more, and maybe Ruth's as well, that is why we're from the same part of the world. And here we are in Dubai in the most stunning, stunning hotel. Huge congratulations on the launch.
Thank you so much.
It's when people walk through the door, I mean, it's soaring ceilings, it's really calming colours. What from a hospitality point of view, what's St. Regis all about, really, Ruth?
So we opened the St. Regis Downtown Dubai on the 1st of October. We're the second St. Regis in Dubai. There's one in the Palm, as you know, and we're the 49th St. Regis globally. We offer the famed traditions, rituals, and the personalized service that people can expect from the St. Regis brand.
Big smiles all the way through from valet. I just wanted to check out the spa, which is the first St. Regis spa in the Middle East.
In the region, yes.
Oh, my gosh. It is something special.
It is. Thank you so much, Helen.
And in terms of dining, we're going to be speaking to Chef Paola very, very soon. There's amazing atmosphere as well down here. We're right next to Basta. We're in the library area now, but Basta for lunch is busy.
It is.
Like, what do I need? What kind of job can I get where I sit and come for lunch at Basta? But in terms of, you know, capacity and obviously expos going on, Dubai feels really busy. You know, what have you got a lot of things going on over the next couple of months?
We have. We've been lucky since we opened. We've been very, very busy from a room side and an F&B side. In the next few weeks, we're of course launching festive season. So there's a lot happening in the hotel for festive. We have our Christmas tree lighting event, which will take place on Saturday, the 4th of December. And then we have Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Boxing Day, lunches, brunches, dinners,
it's all up. It's all, well, we're going to be speaking to Chef about the food side around the festive. Mm-hmm. And being Italian, I'm sure he's got some ideas. But the setting as well is just absolutely stunning. I mean, really, really beautiful. And you've, in terms of the F&B, we've got upstairs, we've got Le Blanc, we've got Basta here as well. Mm-hmm. Can I ask a little bit about, you know, your kind of demographic? Like, is it tourists? Is it business? How do you feel like the hotel's being positioned so far?
We have a real mix. A lot of GCC guests, but a lot of UAE residents and local residents that come to the hotel as well, mm-hmm. especially for the F&B outlets. Basta and Blue Blanc have quite a good position because they were here before.
Yeah.
And they kind of serve as individual restaurants, SBUs, so they have a nice audience, a good following of people that remember them from before. So yeah, they perform very well.
Good.
And now Basta, we've just opened the extended terrace, which stretches the full length of the property.
When I say we're on the canal, it is about 4 meters in front of
literally
me.
Literally on the canal.
It's an amazing, amazing location. Mm. I had a look at the pool. That was torture. How do you work in a hotel where you're like, oh my goodness, people are just enjoying themselves by the pool all the time? But it, you know, in terms of position, you know, great location for the, you know, the business traveller, DIFC, of course, just around the corner as well. Mm. But it's actually a really relaxing vibe. Yeah. It doesn't feel like a frantic business hotel. Does that make sense?
We get that feedback from a lot of guests, actually, because we are in downtown, but we're next to the canal. We have that more resort and relaxed mm-hmm. feel. So you're close to the kind of bustle of the main city of Burj Khalifa and Dubai Mall, but you also have the nice canal views, the kind of quieter, calm atmosphere. So
The spa. We're going to pop something up on our Instagram story so you can see the spa. It's themed by the senses, and we had had a look in one which was like this kind of beautiful cavern where they do the Thai massages. Why are we broadcasting from there, Ruth?
Something very special about the spa, actually. We have 6 signature suites. We don't have spa rooms, we only have spa suites, and every suite has its own sauna and steam room. So it's very unique.
And honestly, they're just the products look beautiful, absolutely stunning spot. So thank you for having us this afternoon.
You're most
even
welcome.
If we're not currently being massaged, I couldn't be happier to be sitting in the library. We're meeting next Chef Paola, the head chef at the St. Regis Downtown Dubai, a little bit about what to expect from the menu. We've got open kitchens and bathrooms upstairs. We've got a really stunning space in Le Blanc. I'm hesitant to say it, but maybe one of the most Instagrammable restaurants in Dubai.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live from St. Regis, downtown Dubai. Live exquisite.
Wonderful to have you with us, and wonderful to welcome head chef, Chef Paola Lothier from the St. Regis, downtown Dubai. Thank you so much for being with us today. I had a look in your restaurant earlier, Le Blanc. It is so beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
It really is an absolutely stunning spot. And we're right next to Basta, which is the all-day dining with a real kind of Italian twist. Where are you from, Chef?
I'm from Italy. I'm originally from Sardinia. And I am working in the St. Regis downtown. Recently been appointed at the St. Regis downtown as a head chef. And Le Blanc is our, new baby.
Your new baby.
Yes.
So growing up then in Sardinia, what kind of food were you eating and who was cooking for you?
Well, it's always our grandmother's food, and they say authentic flavors. Yes.
And how then are you bringing that to Dubai? What you recently had a fresh look at the menu upstairs, yeah. And the grill is kind of really at the heart of a lot of the dishes. Can you make us hungry? And apologies if you haven't had your lunch at 23 minutes past
it's
2.
It's lunchtime. So
it's, yeah, come on, let's get tummies rumbling across Dubai. What are some of your favourite dishes on the menu at Le Blanc?
Well, let's say that the menu at Le Blanc, it's inspired by the southern French coast. And we have brought, let's say, an array of flavourful plates, which are traditional plates from the southern part of France, but in general from the Mediterranean area. If I can say something about Le Blanc, I could say that we upgraded the quality of the ingredients. We brought some new experience in general in the restaurant. So,
like what? I had a little nosy before, and I saw, chef, trays of black stones, and I was thinking, is this decoration? Do I eat the black stones? What is this all about?
Yes, some people might ask if they can eat the black stones.
You don't, eat them. Yeah, but what happens with this?
We on the aperitif, which is the new part of the menu, we have some very interesting snacks, if I can call that. Mm-hmm. For example, the caviar pillows with the caviar on top. It's made with charcoal and creme fraiche, and then we do a pearl of yuzu, which is very refreshing. Then, to be more French, we obviously need to have, and we are proud to have, the foie gras. We do our version with the cherry, so we do the foie gras terrine, and then we glaze with the cherry, so you have a nice saltiness and sweetness at the same time.
Oh, okay, job done. Tummy is rumbling. But what about the grill?
The grill,
when
yeah.
you go in there, it really is front and centre, and you know, I'm sure you have a lot of fun creating dishes on it, and the drama of the sizzle and bringing it out to guests.
Yeah. The grill is basically our ritual every day. So once we switch on the fire in the morning, basically most of the preparation are coming directly from the grill. So from the starters, we have, for example, the dry-aged tartare with the smoked eggplants, which are slow-cooked for a long time in the fire, or the king crab, also the vegetables, the virgin vegetable are smoked in the fire in the wood. And then we move to the main courses, where we have the duck confit, sauce à l'orange, or the toothfish.
It sounds like a holiday to go to Le Blanc. It sounds like you're having a little, like a mini vacation when you go. Can I ask about desserts?
Yes.
Sweet tooth over here. Mediterranean desserts, are you doing kind of ta-ta-ta French style, or what are you doing?
Yeah, we remain, let's say, more classic on the dessert style of the restaurant. However, we for example, the classic tarte-tatin, we just made the caramel ice cream.
Oh, and my goodness.
The vanilla. So, and then the strawberry millefeuille, it's another one must-try on the restaurant. Yes.
Okay, so let's put together... Let's say someone's going to come to Le Blanc this weekend, yes. And you get to choose their meal, starter, main, dessert.
Oh, wow.
Something you feel
quite
like...
Quite long.
Okay, let's try and be restrained, because I'm sure a lot of people could go completely crazy ordering everything. But starter, main, dessert, what do you feel represents you, your foodie philosophy, to get the Le Blanc experience in three dishes, Chef Paolo? What would you recommend?
Well, the caviar pillows and the brandade on the aperitif are really representing the restaurant and, let's say, the style of the restaurant. The caviar pillows, as I said, it's very refreshing. So you will have you will start your journey at the restaurant with the caviar pillows, then a brandade, which is polenta chips, and the brandade is a typical preparation from the southern part of France, and we put vinegar gel, so the bite is like having a fish and chips in one bite. So if you close your eyes, you're going to have that feeling.
Five-star fish and chips.
Yes, exactly. Then on the starters, obviously, we have the selection of oysters. For example, the pink tarbourish from the southern part of France as well. And then dry-aged tartare, smoked eggplants and aioli, and then the king crab. It's another must-try. And I will leave the duck and the toothfish as a choice.
Oh, my goodness. Chef Paolo, thank you so, so much. I know the hotel is really busy. You've got full service going on this evening. So thank you so much for your
time.
Thank
you, Ellen. Thanks.
Really appreciate it. And I absolutely recommend coming down, having a look at this space, and settling down to some of Chef's delicious dishes.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live from St. Regis, downtown Dubai. Live exquisite.
I'm a very, very happy Helen Farmer because a delicious plate of afternoon tea just arrived in front of me. But tying in with our theme of the last hour of eco-anxiety, it is a sustainable afternoon tea. Joining us, we've got Ruth Archer, Director of PR and Marketing, and Chef Paolo Lothier, a TED chef here at the St. Regis downtown Dubai. It's a sustainable afternoon tea. This is called what, Chef?
It's called Tiny Tea.
Tiny Tea. Yeah. So as you'd expect, you know, beautiful kind of bite-sized dishes. What makes this sustainable? What makes it green?
Well, most of the ingredients are sourced from sustainable suppliers around UAE and obviously also around the world. And there is a lot of preparations with sugar, without sugar, without gluten. So we have vegan tarts, we have sugarless chocolate. Which, I mean, the taste is there, but we still don't want to remove the fun part of the cake.
I will be the judge of that. But this is aimed at children as well. With what else are the kids getting apart from a delicious dish? Because there's an education element too.
Yes, so we launched this Tiny Tea in the library, which is the lobby lounge of the St. Regis Downtown Hotel. And we partnered with a local Emirati author. Her name's Ibtisam Al-Baiti. And she's the writer of the book Can I Go Out Now? So the book is all about sustainability. It's teaching children about the environment. So we themed the afternoon tea around the book. And children, when they come to the library, they can enjoy the afternoon tea. And when they buy it, they can also get a copy of the book.
Oh, can I just say, as a parent, that's a really lovely idea to have them entertained.
Thank you.
Because, you know, sometimes you just want to sit and read your book.
Yeah,
have
absolutely.
A chocolate chocolate. Can you quickly talk us through some of your favourite bites on here, Chef? What have we got in front of us?
Well, we have the lollipops, which probably the kids are going to love. Mm-hmm. And they are truffle lollipops. There is the chocolate tart as well, which is vegan, which is this one.
Yum.
Then we have, on the savory part, we have the burger with the organic chicken, with the impossible burger. And then we have the small bruschetta with tomato mozzarella with dry bread.
So I think this is a really wonderful way of introducing kids to alternatives. So we're talking organic, sustainable ingredients, vegan aspects, gluten-free, and it looks fantastic. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to have a little snack. Ruth Archer joining us and Chef Paolo from the St. Regis downtown Dubai, where we are from this afternoon.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live from St. Regis downtown Dubai. Live exquisite.
Delighted to be joined on the phone now by Roxy, who has been on something of a fitness journey over the course of the last month. She was the lucky winner of our enhanced fitness competition, scoring 20 personal training sessions, meal plan, nutrition advice, and Roxy, a really worthy winner because she's getting married this weekend. Roxy, how are you?
Hey, Helen, how are you? I'm good. How are you?
I'm so, so thrilled for you. So you're 30, you're getting married this weekend. Before we talk about how it's been going over the last month with training and food, how are wedding plans going? How are the nerves?
So, okay, for the wedding, we're really, really busy. So, yeah, we're going to get married this Saturday. Regarding the training, so first they did an assessment. So as you're aware, I want 20 meal plans and also 20 personal training sessions. So for the personal training, I'll start with that. So my trainer is Brittany, and she's really, really good and helpful. So if you know, I have a disc, and I'm developing muscle spasm if I overwork my muscles. So first, she asked me what's my goal, what are my concerns. So she made a particular regimen, a workout for me that suits me. So and then for my meal plan, so I have 20 meal plans. And my nutritionist is Natalie, and she was very, very sweet and helpful. So, you know, at first I thought that, you know, they're just going to give me steam chicken breasts and all this kind of stuff, steamed broccoli and this, but it's absolutely sweet. Yeah, you know, I'm like, oh, what are they going to give me? But it's very delicious. And so far I lost 2 kg of fat, so that's very wonderful. And also my muscle has improved. So I'm very, very happy with the results.
Oh, Roxy, I'm really, really thrilled for you. I think a brilliant winner, and you were picked at random, but the fact that you were getting married this weekend and really wanted that transformation and to kind of, you know, have press a bit of a reset button. And it sounds like the team have been brilliant. We spoke to Alexandra McCurr of Enhanced Fitness last week, and she was saying how well you were doing, following the fitness program, the workouts, the meal plan. Now, you've also had some issues with your back. How did that, you know, kind of come into consideration? Have you had to make some adjustments in the fitness plan?
Yeah, so for 3 years now, I've been struggling because I'm having a lower back spasm, and also I have this hip. So sometimes I want to work out, but I'm afraid, you know. But Preeti, she was there to guide me on the workouts that are suited for me. So, and also she gave me exercises to support my lower back. So our lower back is actually connected, so on upper, the buttocks, and to the lower extremities. So we're trying to strengthen the other muscles in order to support my lower back. And so far, it's good. I mean, I feel stronger, actually. So it really helps.
Roxy, we're going to catch up with you very, very soon, find out about some of the meal plan you've been having that's not, as you say, steamed chicken breast and broccoli. So some of your favourites. So do stay with us.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live from St Regis, downtown Dubai. Live exquisite.
Those look forward to here at the St Regis, downtown Dubai, over the course of the next couple of months. We're talking brunches, Christmas and more. I've got it on good authority. The decorations are arriving very, very soon indeed. And joining us live on the line is a recent winner. Roxy won our transformation competition as part of Enhanced Fitness, kicking off Dubai Fitness Challenge. And she won training sessions, consultation with nutritionists and a meal plan, of course. Roxy's 30 and she's getting married this weekend. So a really great time to kind of get you feeling good and looking great, Roxy. Let's talk food, because I think you had your concerns that the food was going to be, well, a little bit boring. Can you tell us about some of your favorite meals you've had over the course of the last few weeks?
So first, last week I had a chicken burger. And then for lunch a while ago, I had quesadilla. That's really delicious. And for breakfast, sometimes I have a pancake with maple syrup. They put protein in it, so it's really, really healthy. And I have this small snacks, chocolate puddings and stuff like that. So it's really enjoying, and, you know, you don't feel bored with the variety of stuff that they are giving.
Well, any diet that includes chicken burgers and pancakes sounds all right by me. Well, huge congratulations, Roxy, from all of us at Dubai Eye on your upcoming wedding. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Congratulations in advance. And all the best. Very happy marriage too. And thank you again to all of the team at Enhanced Fitness for being there on part of that journey.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.